This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Coming up, we'll talk about the president's plans to get human boots back on the moon by 2024 and why that deadline may be scuttled. But first, policing in America, a controversial subject to say the least. And over the last few years, it's only become more heated as several high-profile police-citizen confrontations have gone viral. But today, we're tackling a different part of that conversation, health. The idea that policing has physical and mental health consequences. Some public health researchers say, yes, it might just do that. But before we get into that, let's talk about how policing in America, as we see it today, even came to be. How did we get here? Here to tell us more about that is our first guest, Sam Walker, Professor Emeritus in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Omaha in Nebraska. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you start by defining for us the term proactive policing? What does it mean to police proactively?
Well, contacts between the police and citizens fall into two categories. Proactive actions are where the police initiate the contact. The other category, the majority of them, are reactive. That's where somebody calls 911 or they flag down a police car and the police react to that.
Mm-hmm. And so you have written about the history of proactive policing. Tell us how this sort of policing came to be.
Well, the police always did reactive policing. Proactive policing, where they would initiate some kind of contact. But I think there was a real shift in the late 70s and 1980s, where because of developments in technology and criminology and our understanding of crime and disorder, today's proactive policing programs, a lot of which are referred to as smart policing, are really much better, much more scientific than the old style.
What do you mean by that? Scientific.
They are data driven. And so one of the most popular of the proactive programs is called Hotspots. Mm-hmm. There was this one study. It started out as a small study in Minneapolis, and they discovered that when you analyzed all the 911 calls coming into the Minneapolis Police Department, 5% of the locations in the city accounted for over half of all the police contacts, all of their actions. And so Hotspots represents the idea that you know, crime and disorder is really concentrated in certain geographic areas. And so it logically follows, if you really want to deal effectively with crime and disorder, you concentrate police efforts in those areas. And so this is really smart policing. You know, back in the old days, let's say the old days, like the 1960s, there would be a bunch of robberies or something in a neighborhood, and the police would just flood the area
right
with more patrol cars. That's, let's politely call it, not smart policing. We could call it some other things, but it's not driven by any plan, any data, any strategic objectives.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like the old days where we had the cop on the beat. Would be walking around and getting to know everybody.
The cop on the beat is shrouded in mythology. Mm-hmm. and this idea that, you know, back in the late 19th century, for example, you know, the cop on the beat knew everybody there. Not true. There's mm-hmm. no evidence to support that. That's part of this myth making of, you know, once upon a time there was a golden age that was better than the way things are today.
So what you're saying is once we brought some science into it and we can analyze the data, we can get a better idea of where the crime was happening.
Right. Well, the science told us where it is, mm-hmm. where these bad events are occurring. Then it fell to police departments working with this whole new generation of criminologists to figure out, to develop some strategies for effectively dealing with that crime and disorder.
And did those strategies work?
Some are more effective than others. Most of them, there's very limited evidence about effectiveness. You mentioned the history of proactive policing that mm-hmm. I did. That was a special report commissioned by the National Academy of Sciences, which had a panel. This is their standard operating procedure. And they reviewed all of the evidence on proactive policing. So I was not a member of that panel. They just commissioned me separately to do this paper on the history of proactive policing.
And what did that show, the panel, or the conclusions?
Well, there are some programs which there is some good evidence that that they work, but most of them, there's mixed evidence at best, or weak evidence, or just no evidence at all. And one of the most important findings, which they stress, you know, very strongly in the report, is if you do too much proactive policing in particular neighborhoods or neighborhoods where particular communities, the African-American community lives, Hispanic community lives, you can do a lot of damage. You can result in unconstitutional policing of excessive stops and frisks and arrests. So there's some real problems built into proactive policing.
I want to bring on another conversation, bring on another guest. Liasa Ali Sewell is Associate Professor of Sociology at Emory University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. You've done some research on the health impacts of stop and frisk, a proactive policing tactic that was the focus of much media attention and activism here in New York. First, tell us, what exactly is stop and frisk?
So stop and frisk refers to a criminal surveillance program where people can be stopped on the street because they appear to be a suspect or they appear to be doing something that is wrong.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into the nitty-gritty of your research after the break, but in the big picture sense, what has your research revealed about how this sort of policing impacts health?
My research has shown that policing sickens society. Proactive poor surveillance etches ailment into our neighborhoods and embeds illness into the body.
And you actually went out and studied the statistics on these societies?
Yes. Most of the work, actually all the work that has been published is focused on New York City, which is where we have the best data. And we're using, me and a couple of colleagues are using pretty advanced statistics to boil down and pull apart the ways in which society matters, not just for the individual, but also matters for the context in which the individual is located.
And were you surprised by these results?
Honestly, I was. My work, before I started doing work on policing, my work really focused on housing redlining. And in that literature, we all know that where you live matters. We know it matters for your health and for other types of social outcomes. But when I started to do the work on policing, stop, question, and frisk in particular in New York City, I found that the effects of policing were far more robust than anything I'd ever seen before. So I was very surprised.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in someone who has firsthand knowledge about this. Our producer, Danya Abdelhamid, caught up with a young man named Cassiam Walters to talk with him about his experiences with stop and frisk. He is a 24-year-old Brooklynite, and the first time he was stopped, he thinks he was about 7, but it would happen again and again many times after that.
I'm going to say roughly like a dozen times, and that was like when I started counting. I had a really bad experience in high school. I was a high school senior, so about 17 maybe. I was waiting for my friend. He was deaf, so I was kind of like trying to like get him integrated into the community. I was waiting for him outside of his house, and they came up to me. And they were like, hey, you know, we're truancy cops, and truancy cops who are their sole purpose is to kind of like stop kids from like cutting school. So I guess they thought I was cutting school, and I was like, no, I'm just waiting for my friend. You know, we don't have a zero period or a first period. We start second period. And he was like, you know, like, we're not that dumb. We weren't born yesterday. And he kind of, like, turned me around really roughly. There was nobody else on the block, so, like, no one was able to, like, witness what was going on. And just, like, manhandled me. I'm, like, a little kid at the time. You know, I'm not really built at that age. I'm super scrawny. And really turned me around, roughed me up, emptied my bags, went through my things, my belongings, just, like, threw it all on the floor. And they're like, where is it? And I'm like, where is what? They're like, where is it? We know you have some on you. And they're like, everyone does it. You know, you think you're cool. You cut school to do it, and I'm like, I still don't. I can't connect again. And they were like, okay, well, then you're going to put this back in your bag, and then we'll just catch you another time. You got away this time. You know, when I see a cop now, again, it's not the same fear I had when I was younger, but no matter what, like, and people can say, like, oh, yeah, I know my rights. I'm going to stand up to them at the end of the day. And every single person, especially a black male, there's always a PTSD moment. Even if you haven't had stop and frisk, you know the culture. Like, what do I do when I walk by? And you shouldn't have to feel like that. As a black male, I've never had to think so much about the passing of someone more than I have with a New York City cop or with a cop in general. You know, I think the fear comes from the thought of what could happen if you do this, if I walk home the right way, what could happen? If I pass this precinct, what could happen? If I wear this hoodie today, what can happen? If I wear these certain colors, like, you shouldn't have to, as a young African-American male, say, okay, what colors am I allowed to wear? That sounds crazy. You know, it wasn't until I got out of high school when I was like, this is crazy. And like, that's really how I was. And, you know, I didn't have the, again, I didn't have the guidance around me to say, no, like, you can do this, you can do that. So I just settled, and I settled, and I settled, and I settled. And I think that's another effect on the mind, and it's an effect on your self-esteem, you know, what that can do to a person. It breaks down just your confidence, your social skills. It does so much, because I saw it, you know, spilling into other areas of my life.
Mm-hmm. That was Kasim Walters, a 24-year-old Brooklynite. And this is not uncommon, Sam Walker, as someone who studies this, these kinds of confrontations?
Yes. I should add here that I was an expert witness in the court case that declared the New York City policy unconstitutional. So I had sort of an inside look. I got to see all the policies and procedures and data. And the New York City policy was not smart policing. It was stupid policing. It was also unlawful and unconstitutional. And the story we just heard was repeated, you know, hundreds of thousands of times. But to talk about the health consequences, proactive policing, where the police initiate that contact, well, for all people, you know, that's an unpleasant and uncomfortable, stressful situation. Now, if it's repeated many times, that just jacks up the level of stress and the mental health consequences and the physical consequences. And so, you know, policing that is unconstitutional, as we've just heard described, is also very unhealthy policing for the victims of those stops.
That's what I want to get into after our break. So I want to just take a break now. We'll try to go dissect that, the unhealthy aspects of it for not just the people involved, but the unhealthy aspects about the whole community, how it spills over, as he said, it spilled over into all his aspects of life. We'll talk about it after the break. If you have something you'd like to comment, please, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about proactive policing, including stopping and frisking people, and what mental and social effects it may have. And then now there is real science that has been done to actually figure out how that is happening. My guests are Aliasha Ali Sewell, Associate Professor of Sociology at Emory University, and Sam Walker, Professor Emeritus in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice, University of Omaha. Aliasha, let me get into this a little bit about the science. What sort of physical and mental problems are you seeing in connection with stop and frisk?
So they run the gamut. The gamut includes physical health problems like believing that your health is poor or fair, having a diagnosis of diabetes, having a diagnosis of high blood pressure, even having an asthma episode within the past year, and obesity is linked to higher levels of obesity.
And is this affecting people of all ages or of where they live? Or what is the demographics of this?
Well, the first couple of studies I did, they looked at all ages, everybody over 18. So there is work on how policing affects youth, primarily thinking about the direct effects of it. So if you are personally stopped, the extent to which that is going to be linked to higher levels, primarily of mental health problems, of psychological distress. But in my studies, I use adults going up to the age of 95.
Wow. And you're saying now you can, because of these studies, draw a direct line between the policing practices and the health of the people.
And particularly the policing practices that are happening within a context, within the neighborhood. So the primary, the strongest relationship is linked to absolute levels of use of force and physical and mental health problems. This includes all the ones I just mentioned to you, as well as psychological distress. There's also increases of mental health problems among neighborhoods where people are having force used against them. And there's also higher levels of physical health problems in neighborhoods where there are large racial disparities. This is referring to the relative rate of use of force against minorities compared to their white counterparts.
Mm-hmm. Does this affect men and women the same way?
It actually doesn't. And in most of the research that looks at this focuses on male populations. So until the study that I did, which came out in Social Science and Medicine, actually compared men and women living in the same neighborhood, the extent to which they experienced psychological distress, you really didn't know that the burden is, at least with regards to psychological distress, is stronger among men.
Hmm. What about the difference between relative and absolute use of force?
So there's a lot of evidence that suggests that the overall rate of use of force and frisking, and this is different than just being stopped. Now, being stopped itself is linked to higher levels of poor health among Latinos and higher levels of high blood pressure among both Blacks and Asian Pacific Islanders. But you also find that it's linked to things such as racial disparities in the stop. That's also linked to physical health problems primarily. But the absolute measures that I use, which are basically higher levels of frisking, higher levels of use of force, they've been linked to all, both physical and mental health problems. They've been found to experience higher levels of illness if you're predominantly in a Black or Latino neighborhood, primarily if you're male. And in the case of high blood pressure, which is a really interesting case, Latinos and Asians actually have higher rates of high blood pressure if they live in neighborhoods where there's large uses of force among the pedestrians.
Mm-hmm. You know, this almost seems intuitive, does it not, that people would suffer from feeling targeted on the street? I guess what you're doing is actually scientifically investigating and putting data behind those feelings.
Well, that is true, and just to be clear, I don't necessarily study whether you yourself are stopped and then whether you yourself have illness problems. I examine the environment, the policing environment, the types of practices that are happening to pedestrians after the stop occurs. If in areas where the stop is more likely to result in frisking, particularly, and use of force, you're seeing higher levels of physical health and mental health problems.
Mm-hmm. What are some
independent of whether you personally are stopped?
Mm-hmm. Sam Walker, have police departments started to change their procedures in light of this new research?
Actually, all of the protests that followed Ferguson 5 years ago, 5 years and a couple mm-hmm. of months, the national protests and all of the other incidents in Baltimore, Cleveland, and around the country have had an important positive effect. I'm actually giving a paper on this in November. There's been an extraordinary outburst of reform. Now, the problem in several different areas of life, state legislatures have passed, you know, numerous laws. Lumber City Councils have passed new procedures for holding the police accountable. There is one group of police chiefs, Police Executive Research Forum, which is, you know, far more progressive than the main group, the IECP, and they've been doing some tremendous things. So there is a lot happening. There's cause for optimism. The problem is the national news media focuses on the bad news. You know, the evening news, it's the shooting, it's the beating, and so on. And so the conventional wisdom among most people is that, well, gee, nothing's happened since Ferguson. Actually, a lot has, and there's a lot of cause for some cautious optimism about that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Orlando, Audrey in Orlando. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
My question was, I'm a master's in criminal justice student, well, I just graduated. And one of my questions was, could there be an argument made, because I had one professor that made this argument, that minorities are primarily stopped due to crime mapping and the, not so much as their ethnic makeup, but the neighborhoods that they live in and the crime that takes place there. Can that argument actually be made, or is there data that proves otherwise?
Okay, let's get an answer. I'll ask this, or Sam?
Yeah, I think my work speaks directly to that, because in all of the analysis that I do, I actually adjust for the crime levels of the neighborhood. So we actually get data from New York Police Department on whether people are calling in about robbery complaints or homicides or so on and so forth. And we actually are able to wipe away the variation in health that is due to crime. Hmm. We're also able to wipe away the relationship between policing and health that is linked to crime. So the numbers that I mentioned to you before, you know, something between, you know, a 9% or more increase in physical health problems, physical mental health problems in neighborhoods where there's large levels of frisking and use of force, that is independent of the crime in those neighborhoods.
Do people who feel like they have mental problems, can they go get help for this as a legitimate reason for feeling that way?
I mean, I think that's where we're moving towards. I think one of the key things that my work has been doing is establishing a public health relationship mm-hmm. that suggests that, in fact, policing itself is an epidemic. So it's creating an epidemic of assaults. It's creating an epidemic of illness. And it's a type of epidemic that's not going to go away just because we're starting to delegalize stop and frisk. That effect is going to stay in the body because the types of illnesses that form when someone is stopped and they're under a climate of fear, those things get encoded into the body, get embedded further and deeper into our cells.
Sam Walker, what do you think about this?
Well, you mentioned crime mapping. Hotspots policing, which is the most successful program, most widely used program, is a form of mapping. You're identifying those parts of town where there you have the highest rates of crime and disorder. Well, the fact of the matter is those are low-income neighborhoods, and they are primarily neighborhoods of people of color. And so this highly respected program, Hotspots, it has this aura of science about it. Wow, it's driven by data. You know, this is really good stuff. Well, you're concentrating, you know, police, whether it's stops, frisks, and other things, on a particular segment of the population. And the primary targets are young black men. And that's confirmed by every bit mm-hmm. of good data that we have. And so I think we're just beginning to get to the point of thinking that, wait a minute, we need to rethink, you know, these kind of scientifically data-driven programs because of their impact on a particular part of our community.
Mm-hmm. Ali, what do you think about that?
You know, I think that the case I want to talk to you about is high blood pressure. High blood pressure is one moment within the life cycle where the way you respond to stress changes. And what I've found is that when you talk about the relative use of force, the most palpable associations with illness is in regards to high blood pressure. So in areas where minorities are more likely to have force used against them and more likely to be frisked, there's higher levels of high blood pressure. But I also want you to understand that it's not just minority areas or minority people. So there's a paper that came out in Sociological Forum, which suggested that in predominantly white neighborhoods where black and brown pedestrians were targeted for use of force, you see higher levels of physical health problems, cardiovascular disease, metabolic issues, regards to obesity in those neighborhoods than comparable white neighborhoods where black, brown, and white pedestrians are treated the same.
Wow. Great discussion. We're going to have to end it there. I'd like to thank my guests, Aliassa Ali Sewell, Associate Professor of Sociology at Emory University, Sam Walker, Professor Emeritus in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice, University of Omaha in Nebraska. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.